So we come to the end of our day, and I just felt like the beginning now of the talk, just I guess expressing my gratitude. It's very nice to come and sit together. I really enjoyed today just sitting here quietly and sitting, getting a chance to sit with you all and met some of you. And it's a very nice feeling for me. I feel very grateful for the opportunity and for the time together. The talk I want to give today is kind of, I would call a talk in progress. What it is maybe all the talks are talks in progress, but I have this theme that I've been thinking about for a little while now, and so it's kind of my continuation of my thinking about this this topic that I would give this talk. So it's an exploration for me, and that is the topic is that of sacredness or the sacred, because the editors of the Inquiring Mind, they asked me a couple of weeks ago if they could consult with me or talk to me about the sacred and the issue of the sacred and the for what they had this in mind, this tension between the sacred and liberation. I don't know if there's a conflict between them, but so I started thinking about the sacred from a Buddhist point of view. What is sacred? And what is a sacred from a Buddhist perspective? And in thinking about this, I felt part of what Buddhism is, the function of Buddhism is to inspire us, encourage us, support us in our attempt to practice awareness, awakening, liberation, compassion. But also, as important as that, is that Buddhism is supposed to challenge us. Buddhism is not supposed to be too comfortable. If Buddhism was comfortable, it wouldn't serve much purpose, maybe. So part of it is both to inspire us and be a place of comfort and refuge, but also, and on the other hand, at the same time, it's supposed to challenge us, and we're not supposed to be too comfortable with it. What do you mean they say that? What do you mean the teacher says that? Wait a minute, I don't know if I agree with that, or this doesn't work, this doesn't feel right to me, or this goes against everything I've ever thought about, and who I thought I was, and am, and you know, it's not supposed to be comfortable. It's supposed to be, you know, a challenge. Not that Buddhism has the answer, but part of the function is that to help us look at the deeper, deepest assumptions we have about our life and about ourselves, about the world we live in, kind of stir things up. And so I like very much the famous metaphor, simile, that the Buddhism is like a raft. All it is a raft to take us across the river, but then you don't want to carry the raft with you once you get across the river. It'd be a silly thing to do. And part of the way it's a raft is that it challenges us to think more deeply, explore more deeply. And so this word sacred is a very important word in the West. It's a Western religious term, kind of a Latin term, a Catholic term, Christian term. And what I found interesting is that there's no easy Buddhist, in Buddhist languages, there's no easy equivalent for the word sacred. So that's interesting for me, whenever you don't find an easy term. And it's true for Indian religions and religions in general. I think in Sanskrit there's no easy term that translates the English word sacred. And there's a lot of interesting words, English words, that we don't find Indic words or Buddhist words. The word spirituality is one. You're going to translate the word spirituality, you don't find a word in Sanskrit or Pali that works very well for it. You might find some, but you have to kind of stretch the meanings and stuff. And the word religion. So both, some people hate the word religion, so they choose the word spirituality to talk about what they're doing. But Buddhism doesn't have a word for either one of them. So where does that put you? And then, of course, the word Buddhism itself. There's no Buddhist word for the word Buddhism. So there's no ism called Buddhism. The Buddha himself, he called what he taught the Dharma Vinaya, the teaching and the, whatever Dharma means, the teaching and the training was what he taught. And later it became the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, but it wasn't necessarily the same thing as a Buddhism. And my favorite, maybe of all, because we're in California, maybe more challenging to all of us here in California, more than, you know, spirituality or religion or Buddhism, you know, we can do without those, fine. But the word emotion, there's no easy equivalent word for the English word emotion in Sanskrit or Pali. And how could you have a whole religion that doesn't talk about, doesn't have the word emotion? I mean, it's this emotion-denying religion. It doesn't have any place for emotions and doesn't have any teachings about emotions. And Buddhists have all the emotions you have. And Buddhism, you know, talks about the particular kind of emotions, but it has no category called emotions. It's not a category for Buddhism. Now, how does that work? You know, and how could it be? How can this be successful? You know, major world religion doesn't have a category called called emotions. You know, is there something we can learn? We can learn from that. Can we be challenged by that and look more deeply at our assumptions? There are people in the West who will kill each other, seemingly, about their opinions about emotions and how you're supposed to be with them. And here we have a religion that doesn't have an opinion about emotions because it doesn't have a word for it. What then? So anyway, the sacred. And part of, I think, what's interesting about looking at another religion, another culture, is perhaps we kind of will listen to or look at Western concepts with fresh eyes, with fresh ears, and see, but maybe there's something here to be studied, not just simply take them for granted. Part of the difficulty with the word sacred, it often conveys a kind of a sense or a feeling more than it does a particular meaning. And people use the word, oh, it's the sacred, as an adjective or as an abstract noun. And two people can use the word with very different meanings, but they think they're talking about the same thing. And it's kind of one of these key words. You use the word sacred, you put the words as an adjective before whatever you say. You know, sacred space, sacred day, sacred person, sacred teachings or whatever. And you kind of get kind of, some people get kind of soft. Oh, yes. It kind of inspiring, it's a wonderful word. It's an evocative word. So it evokes things. It evokes a certain kind of sensitivity, certain sensibility. And if we have a kind of spiritual yearning, it kind of evokes this spiritual yearning and the objects of the yearning. But it's not even clear that the people are using the word sacred with the same definition. There's many, many meanings that the word sacred has in Western culture. And I suspect that when we use the word sacred, we don't always have the same reference for the word. And maybe it's because of the ambiguity behind the word that it can be used to be so evocative or to inspire or convey something of an emotional sense rather than of any real sense, a meaning sense. So sacred has many meanings. Now, traditionally in the West, I think it's connected to the divine, to that which is of the gods or of God, and expressions of divine power, of divine energy, are often considered sacred. And a lot of things were considered to have the expressions of divine power. A lot of things were fearful. And traditionally, it's apparently very traditional that which is sacred is also connected with that which is fearful. And people were afraid of the sacred. So, well, sacred wasn't this wonderful, nurturing, kind of maternal, nice thing. The sacred is something, you know, it's like this wrathful God. You know, you don't get close to the sacred without you get burned if you get too close to that which is sacred. So there's tremendous kind of reverence and awe and distance. You know, the sacred, you have to approach it in a certain way. You have to have a certain kind of respect. You have to have a certain kind of purity of intent or purity of being. Because you had to kind of, the sacred was something very, very special that you didn't mess with. You didn't come up against it casually. I was thinking about this, I thought it was interesting that I suspect that it's very hard for us to remember or to recognize the degree to which we live in a domesticated world. That the world that we live in doesn't have the same kinds of fears and threats that the world of our ancestors had of just a few hundred years ago. And so much of our, you know, our world has been Bambiized. No, it hasn't been Bambiized? What? Right, maybe not. It depends where you go. It's kind of a combination of things. But a lot has been domesticated. So the sacred is also connected in some people's minds to ultimate reality, that which is most ultimate, the ultimate other, what has ultimate meaning or ultimate value, that which imparts ultimate meaning to life. So sometimes the sacred is that which is the truth with a big T, or the sacred sometimes is connected to peak experiences. For some people, the ultimate is not out there anymore. It's not like the sacred place or sacred ultimate reality or sacred God, but it's its peak experience that we can have. And that's what's most sacred. Some people, it's love. For some people, it's that which is larger than any sense they have of the self, who they are as a person. That larger reality than the self is, that's the sacred. So I don't have, I'm not going to offer you the definition. I don't know if there's the definition, but there's many different definitions that people have. And I suspect that when people use the word sacred casually, we sometimes might miss each other unless we ask, you know, how are you defining the word? What do you mean here? Now, an important part of, important aspect of the sacred traditionally, as the word was originally coined, I think, which was explicit, and I think in our language, in our use of it, probably is implicit more than we realize, is that the word sacred is paired with the word profane. And sacred, apparently in Latin, meant the inside of a temple, the inner sacred, the inner divine place where the divinity rests in the temple, the wall, that which is set apart from everything else, from the secular, from the worldly. And the profane literally means that which is in front of the temple, which was not, you know, not inside the sacred walled off area, but the place that was outside of it, in front of it, was the literal word meaning of it. And the only way that this word has any meaning for us anymore, I think, for many of us, in our vocabulary, is profanities. We don't want to speak profanities. We don't want to profane something. You know, in the sense of, you know, the profane is a profanity. That it's really something terrible and bad, and the sacred is that which is ultimately good. So one of the meanings of the sacred is that which is set apart. And so there's a division, a duality between something, between that which is inside and that which is outside, that which is apart and that which is, you know, not apart. A division between the sacred and the profane, between the spiritual and the secular, the worldly and the otherworldly. And in the West, we have a legacy of, there's many, many legacies in the West. This isn't like the only one. But there's one legacy we have is that of a very radical split between that which is sacred and the world, the worldly. You know, being in the world is not really where the sacred's at. Our sexuality is not sacred. Our body is not sacred. Money is not sacred. All these parts of the world is not sacred. The sacred is something other. It's, you know, in the church. The church is sacred. God is sacred. Going to heaven is sacred. Texts are sacred. But you try to spend your time in the sacred world, and you try to avoid best you can that which is not sacred, the profane, which for some people at certain times were just ordinary everyday kind of things like the body and relationships and working and having a job and. So there's a kind of a split, and I believe that some of the things were quite explicit in our cultural baggage, our cultural background, tend to become implicit or hidden sometimes in our approach to our spiritual life in contemporary life. And many of us also react explicitly against that kind of split, and I think a lot of American Buddhists are very adamant about reacting against a radical duality between the world and another world, between the secular and the spiritual. And there's a strong emphasis on wanting to find our spiritual practice in our normal life, which is a beautiful thing, not to create these sharp divisions. And traditionally in Buddhism, there is also these divisions. In some, there's legacies, there's channels or lineages in Buddhism also of a sharp division between the worldly and the otherworldly. And when Westerners tend to kind of encounter those lineages of Buddhism, they tend to react against it, saying, "Well, I don't want to be part of that." Because what's, you know, they don't want to believe there's something inherently wrong with just being in the world and working and being in relationships in their body and sexuality and all these things. There's a meditation center in Southern California that's called Ordinary Dharma. You know, I think it's part of this that legacy, that lineage of not creating the sharp duality. To find the sacred in all kinds of things, and to find it in washing dishes. But the question is, what makes these things sacred? When we want to sacratize our ordinary life, our ordinary reality, what makes it sacred? And there's two kind of ways, if we look at it more deeply. One is the notion that these things connect us to the divine. These things are connections to something which has ultimate value for us, ultimate importance. They connect us with love. They connect us with nirvana. They connect us with God or whatever. And in this sense, it's kind of a utilitarian approach. All these things are sacred because they're sacred because they're bridges to something else. We're going to get someplace else through this. They're not sacred in and of themselves. So I remember at Stanford some years ago, a student who was somewhat idealistic in his spiritual life, talking about how wonderful it is to be in relationship, for him to be in a relationship with a woman, and being very intimate, having union with a woman, and how for him it's an experience of cosmic unity. He feels like it dissolves into the cosmos, and he's just one with everything and everything, the whole universe. And I asked him, "And how does she feel while you're having this? You dissolve into the cosmos and have this great union." And you know, it's a wonderful ideal, you know. But you know,
how did she feel?
I never had a chance to meet her or ask her, and he didn't. You know, he kind of, you know. It startled him that I asked him the question. I think he realized that he had created a very sharp division. And somehow the humanity of that person was lost in his idealism for some great other. And it isn't that his, you know, that wasn't a wonderful experience to have. And I don't want to deny him the experience, but you have to realize what was going on also. And maybe he, you know, for him then, this relationship was a bridge to something greater. And that's one way that people want to find the sacred in ordinary life. It's a bridge rather than... The other way is to see that it's sacred in and of itself. Now, what does that mean? I don't really... You know, it's not a word that I use a lot, the sacred. So, you know, I'm not here to give you the answers. Remember, this is a talk in progress. I hope it's interesting for you. Maybe none of you care about the sacred either. You know, I don't care that much. So hopefully you care enough that it's interesting to talk. But what I'm concerned about is that as we focus on the sacred, those of us who focus and use the word, that we pay attention that there might be implicit, kind of hidden assumptions in the use of the word. A hidden kind of implicit divide between something. You know, because traditionally the sacred is a division, the sacred and the profane. So even as we try to make the whole world sacred, I'm a little bit suspect of the attempt. It's a wonderful idea, let's make the whole world sacred. But it's like Lao Tzu, the Taoist sage, who said, you know, oh, it's now that we have precepts, all these kind of Taoist or Confucian precepts and ways we have to live our life, it's symptomatic that something's gone wrong. That we need them. And So maybe if we need to sacralize the world, it indicates that something's wrong, that we have to do it. It's kind of like putting a bandage over something rather than healing the wound. Maybe. So I'm concerned that even if we try to sacralize the whole world, still we're left with kind of a division or some kind of implicit assumption that we haven't looked at. Why the need to even try to do that? Is it that something, you know, one of the great practice questions is, what is unacceptable for you? What is unacceptable? And if you look at the word, you know, trying to find the sacred in your life, is there still something which is unacceptable, something which is outside the sacred, something which you're not willing to include within that? It's a great question. What is unacceptable for you? And I suspect that in the move to find life sacred, to find our body sacred, our sexuality, I use these because this is very popular in the last 20, 30 years, those, our body and our sexuality. There's probably other areas. You don't hear people talk about the sacredness of money that often. There's not tantric workshops on money. But, you know, it has juice for it in the West, in certain areas of our life. But as we do this, and it's connected to in my mind, to the notion, let's celebrate our body, let's celebrate our life, let's celebrate, whatever. It's fine to celebrate, it's great to celebrate, but I'm always interested, what is the implicit assumptions behind these kinds of approaches? And is there still a kind of division, an unnecessary division, which is actually causing suffering, even though in the excitement and the joy of celebration, the painful separation is noticed. And one of those divides, one of the things I think that is not noticed so well, one of maybe the wall that creates the divide as we try to sacralize the whole world, is the self, is myself, is I, the I. And I hear sometimes that people who want to find the sacred in everything and want to insist, you know, it's like a manifesto, let's celebrate our body, let's celebrate this and that and being in the world. And it's like, what I hear sometimes is this tremendous, I am the one who's doing it. And I am the one who's, you know, the agent of sacredness. I'm the one who's going to share in the sacredness. I'm going to be the one who gets all this stuff. And sometimes I wonder if we don't look at this, at the divide that's created by self and not self, that we're actually going to, there's still some suffering there. And I wonder if, I don't have the answer to this, but I wonder whether the attempt to sacralize the whole world, to find an ordinary life sacred, if we don't really look very carefully at the sense of self that we're bringing to that, that whether we still remain with some kind of division. And it's very difficult to see the ingrained reference we have of an I, of a self within us. And we know, ever since Chogyam Trungpa wrote his great book, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, that a lot of spiritual practice is a form of spiritual materialism. Where, you know, it's, and how Trungpa defined it is that it's using spiritual practice to enhance or support the egotistic sense of self. You know, so you get this one, you know, get this great badge. You know, and I saw it, you know, the Zen Center where I lived at. When I first showed up there, everybody was going around with Amish vests, fat pants, Birkenstocks, and Danish school bags. It was like this uniform. And you were really spiritual then. You know, spirit. What does that mean? What did spiritual mean? I think it was a kind of spiritual materialism. That they were someone. They were connected to the group. They were special in the group. They were recognized. You know, and it enhances, you know, security and sense of self and pride and all kinds of things. So there's the ingrained, invisible reference of I. Also, I'm concerned about this idea of sacred because ideas of sacred can be oppressive, and that it can, in that there can be a sense that there's some kind of divine reality or special reality where it's really at, that's different than where I'm at now. And since I'm not there, there's something wrong with me. I'm inadequate. I'm, I, you know. you know, I need to get with it. I need to kind of go off and do a long pilgrimage. I need to do something. I need to kind of get myself a Danish school bag and an Amish vest. And you know, maybe then I'll be where it's at. I need to relate to people in a certain way. There's a perfect way of doing things. There's a spiritual way. There's a sacred way of doing things. And if only I figure out that perfect sacred way of doing it, then, you know, everything will be okay. Or there's a pure essence. The fallacy of essentialism. There's a pure essence of who I am. And if I find that pure essence, everything else is going to be okay. The key to all my problems. I have this book at home. It's a very nice book. It's full of nice little stories. It's a spirituality from the point of view of AA, or AA spirituality, I guess. But the title of the book is called something like The Spirituality of Imperfection. And I love it because we don't want to get trapped in the notion of perfection, that there's a perfect way of being, of becoming. And rather, the spirituality of imperfection, the spirituality of just being a person who doesn't understand everything and doesn't get everything right and stumbles through life. I mean, isn't that more the reality anyway? Or you're holding out for doing it just perfect and just never making a mistake again the rest of your life? Is that what you're holding out for? Well, good luck. In Buddhism, the world is neither sacred nor profane, is my contention. The body is neither sacred nor profane. The body is not defiled. The body is not sacred. It's not pure. Buddhism is neither religious or irreligious. It's neither spiritual nor secular. It's neither good or bad. In Buddhism, they say over and over again, the world is simply what it is. And so we have this famous expression in Buddhism, to see things as they are. Or in Mahayana Buddhism, that's a Theravada way of saying it, things as they are. In Mahayana Buddhism, they say suchness or thusness. The word is the Sanskrit word is as strange as the English. It's ta-ta-ta. And that into English becomes suchness or thusness. The suchness of things. Things are just as they are. Things are such as they are. We don't have to blame the world or the body or the mind for our problems, for our difficulties, for anything. Things are as they are, with our problems, with our foibles. And Buddhism is a practice of learning to see things as they are, not learning to see things as they should be. I had this letter from someone recently, and he said, he's this, you know, old man, and he's lamenting the fact that he realized that how much energy he spent his life trying to see things as they should be, when he could have spent his time seeing things as they are. And he missed so much, he said. He looked back over his life and he said he missed so much. He missed his children, he missed his spouse, he missed, you know, because he kept seeing things as they should be rather than how they actually were. And as any of us who I think who practice to some degree realize the tremendous degree that we overlay ourselves, the world, our reality, our relationships with judgments, with opinions, with prejudices, with ideas, with divisions, this and that. And Buddhism has a tremendous respect, and I think anybody who practices, tremendous respect and respect is really the word, for the tremendous power of the mind to overlay meanings, interpretations on experiences of our life and to cause suffering because of it. This week I came across this quote by Hamlet. I think when it goes something like, things are neither good or bad, but mind makes it so. Is that what someone, I had it wrong?
Thinking
makes it so. Things are neither good or bad, but thinking makes it so. You're the one, someone told, Monday someone knew it. But the Monday person's not here, right?
Yeah, actually quoted anyway.
Oh, that's good enough for me. It doesn't matter who said it. It's a good thing to say. And in Mahayana Buddhism, there's this famous sutra called Vimalakirti Sutra. And this enlightened layman who makes a fool of all of the Buddha's disciples, enlightened disciples. And he says basically the same thing. Shariputra was considered to be the Buddha's wisest disciple. And the Mahayanas loved to make fun of Shariputra, because even the wisest Theravadan monk is not supposed to have as much wisdom as the Mahayanists, so they were always making fun of the wisest. Maybe it's not a very kind thing to do. But anyway, and so Shariputra represents this, for them, the Mahayanists. Now, he wasn't this way in life, but he represents the ultimate kind of guy who's going to create this sharp division between the world and the ultimate, which is pure. And Shariputra, when he sees the world, he sees just impurity. So he says, "As for me, I see this great earth with its highs and lows, its thorns, its precipices, its peaks and its abysses, as if it were entirely filled with ordure, shit." I don't know how to pronounce it. And then this other person who says, "The fact that you see such a world as this, as if it were so impure, Reverend Shariputra, is a sure sign that there are highs and lows in your mind, and that your positive thought in regard to the Buddha wisdom is not pure either. Reverend Shariputra, those whose minds are impartial towards all living beings and whose positive thoughts towards the Buddha wisdom are pure, see this world as perfectly pure." Another way of saying this is that if your mind is caught up in notions of pure and impure, then you'll see the world as being pure, impure. And you don't have to interpret and overlay that kind of interpretation on the world. The world is simply what it is, and we learn to see it for what it is. In part, this Mahayana rhetoric is an attempt to heal a division that grew in the history of Buddhism over the centuries, and between a kind of division between the worldly and the transcendental, and between between nirvana and samsara. And by the time the Mahayana Buddhists were saying nirvana is samsara, they had to say it because Buddhism had created a tremendous divide between the two, that there was kind of... But in early Buddhism, in the teachings of the Buddha, there was no sharp division between samsara and nirvana to begin with. So the Buddha didn't have to say that. It's kind of the same as maybe in Christianity. I know next to nothing about Christianity. But it's, some people will say that the teachings of Jesus... he emphasized that the kingdom of God is within, or the kingdom of God is spread out across the land, I think, were two famous quotes. And then as Christianity developed, there developed a very sharp divide between that which was sacred and that which was profane, the secular and the religious world. And it wasn't that the kingdom of God was found everywhere. The kingdom of God was up in heaven, and this world was something to renounce in some areas of Christianity. The same thing happened in Buddhism. And the teachings of the early Buddha was just things as they are. You didn't create a sharp divide. But then eventually there was a division created, and then Buddhists had to cope with that. And so then they had all these complicated teachings to try to heal the divide. Things as they are, to be with things as they are, to see things as they are, might sound to some people as being kind of a flat state, emotionally flat. You know, how boring things as they are. But it's not a flat state. It's not an emotionally flat experience. And it's very interesting that for some people, the fear arises that to be with things as they are is boring, or it's bland, or it's not exciting, or it's not good enough, or it's insecure, or not safe. It has a lot to do with this self-reference again. You know, what is it? What's in it for me? But the world as it is, to see that or participate in it, is a participation. It includes our participation in this reality. And it's an intimacy with the world when there's no being, no one being intimate. So what's that like? What good is that to you? You know, if you're going to be intimate with everything, but you can't be there to be intimate, you know, why bother? Does that make sense? Or am I just talking to myself? And my own experience is that when we can get out of our own way, in a sense, we want to be careful not to make a division here between being in my way and not being in my way. We are with things as they are, including my problems and my difficulties. There's a kind of richness to life. Recently, I was inspired by a reference to Gandhi that someone who knew him said, commented that he was, Gandhi was very busy. He apparently, you know, even in his 70s, he worked 7 days a week, 15 hours a day. And he had this abundant amount of energy, you know, for this great cause, liberating India from the English. And someone asked him, you know, how can he have all this energy? And he said, because I'm always at rest. And that was inspiring to me, because I'm busy and I get frazzled and get tired and overwhelmed by all the things I do at times. But this idea, I'm always at rest in whatever I do. And I think that's a real possibility for us, is to find rest. And that's why I kind of mentioned at the beginning of the day the possibility of looking for that which is restful in the midst of your experience. Not changing your experience, but resting in the midst, finding, leading yourself, moving into that which is restful in the experience, rather than struggling with it. But to be at rest. Ajahn Sumedho said the same thing once. He said, he travels a lot, he flies all over the world. And there was one trip where it was going to take him all the way around the globe. And I think, as I remember it, he felt a little bit overwhelmed. He's one more long trip. It's kind of tiring to fly a lot and sleep in different places every night or whatever. And he decided at the beginning of that trip that he was going to take the attitude that he wasn't going anywhere. He was not going anywhere. The world was going by him. And he said at the end of that trip he was rested rather than exhausted. So things as they are is what is left when we neither strive or resist, manipulate or project. There's this great saying, you know, after the ecstasy, the laundry, which has a lot of spiritual truth to it. Or another way of saying this is, after the ecstasy, just this. And sometimes, you know, the high peak experiences are peak experiences, like you kind of pendulum swings up. And really, you know, in some sense, you know, the natural state is not peak experiences, but is when the pendulum comes to the middle point again, and just things as they are. In many retreats I've been on, you know, I go through my great difficulties and great striving and great peak experiences and all kinds of stuff. And then the end of the retreat, some point in the retreat, you know, I'm just, sometimes it's the last day of the retreat, you know, I'm no longer striving, I'm no longer trying to attain anything, I'm no longer caught up in the whirlwind of all kinds of good or bad experiences, and I'm not trying to be somewhere else and whatever. I'm just here, just in a very simple way. Just here. The piano's playing, just piano music, the piano's playing, and sometimes they seem to miss a note, just things as they are. You know, and these loud shoes walking by, just things going on, you know. The wind, it feels like the ocean breeze, and you feel the wind. And, you know, I'm talking, it's just what's happening. And nice light in the room in the afternoon, it's just what's happening. Sitting here, and you're hungry, and you're tired. It's just things as they are. You just, kind of contentment, just allowing, I don't know if that's the right word, just allowing things to be as they are. After the ecstasy, things as they are. Just this. So, since it's a work in progress, maybe I should just stop. I don't have to finish. So I'll stop. But sacred is a Latin word, and we have an Anglo-Saxon word too, which is the holy. And the holy has different roots to it. And sacred has its temple associations. Profane and sacred come from the Latin words having to do with sacred space, you know, in the temple and outside. The holy, as the etymologists say, is connected to English words heal and whole, holistic. And maybe that's in Buddhism. The holy is a better word because it's the world as it is when it's whole, when it's complete, when it includes everything, when it's undivided. When we stop making the divisions between sacred and profane. When we stop making a sharp division between ourselves when we're perfect and when we're not perfect. Ourselves when we get it right and we don't get it right. Ourselves when, you know, just, it's okay to be. When we allow ourselves to be as we are, to see ourselves as we are, and it's okay. Not to make a problem of our problems. So you might experiment with periods of time in your daily life. It might take 5 minutes or 20 minutes, or you might ask a friend to impose on you 20 minutes. Say, okay, you should do this. Now's the 20 minutes. You do this exercise. When you allow things to be as they are, including yourself, rather than seeing things as a problem and unacceptable. Or difficulty. For the next 20 minutes, I'm just going to let things be as they are. As if they're okay. Whatever happens, whatever's going on is fine, just the way it is. I don't have to change it or make it worse or resist it or fight it. To be with things as they are. So, maybe all of you are like me, you don't care about the sacred too much. Maybe some of you do. I use the word occasionally, but not that often. When I use the word, I think I connect it to most sacred to me is that which is connected to our intention to become awake and become free, to be compassionate, that intention. So there's some things that represent that, to support that. So, you know, this is a sacred day for me in some sense because it's a beautiful intention that brings us together here. But that's dangerous to say that. It's a holy day. So, any comments? Questions?
I like these kind of bridges for the sacred. I think a very useful word. Anything that reminds us of something beyond this reality, or I guess that's not the right way to put it, but another state of consciousness, being awake, what's available when you're awake. Probably most of us have things in our houses that remind us.
Remind us. And the one of the beautiful tricks, though, is to then expand what reminds us to include even the most mundane, so that everything reminds us. I'm very fond of the Heart Sutra, Mahayana Sutra, that says, "Form is emptiness; emptiness is form." And perhaps there's a way in which the sacred is profane, and the profane is sacred. That the way the bridges are both bridges, the bridges to themselves. Because it isn't that the bridges are to something else beyond them, but the bridges is really pointing to themselves. The sacred is here. Maybe. But yeah, it's a nice word, the bridges.
Great article.
Sorry?
Great article.
Article?
In progress.
In progress. You want to transcribe it? So? Now we've done away with the sacred. What's next? What do you want to do away with next?
I have a comment.
Yes.
That seems to go along with what you were talking about. I was in some environment where some man brought up this great, what I thought was this great idea. This family has a blessing pot, and throughout the whole year, they put things, wonderful things, I guess, that they interpret that happened to them into this pot, and then at some point in the year, maybe Christmas or Thanksgiving, some defined point, they get together and they read through all the things in the pot. And I thought it was such a wonderful idea. I had one of my friends make me a blessing pot as a gift. And then what I noticed is I never put anything in there. And when I really think about it, what I really wonder, why do I never put anything in there? And it, when I think of it, becomes very arbitrary whether this is a blessing or this isn't a blessing. It's like anything I could choose to be a blessing, or it's up to me at any point whether I choose that to be. So it's a funny thing when I have my pot because I never put anything in it.
Maybe you should make it into practice.
But it's...
Force yourself.
But what do I find to be a blessing is kind of like saying this is sacred, this isn't.
Oh, that way. Oh, I see.
You know, it's like...
I see.
It's starting when I really think of it. It's at any point, it's an arbitrary choice.
Maybe, but you know, it's okay to have divisions too. It's okay to have separations. And remind, at the end of the year, you can remind yourself, and maybe the pot of joy, and you just write whenever you feel joy, because you can feel joy in spite of yourself. A blessing is a little bit abstract because you have to kind of think, oh, this is a blessing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a little bit conceptual. Nice things are happening to you, and then, oh, this is a blessing. So you think about, but joy, you don't have to think about, you don't have to create the joy through a concept, just feeling joy. So maybe it's easier, just your joy pot. And write down something about joy.
Or maybe I want to put everything in there.
Put everything
like,
in there.
You know, maybe the whole house is a blessing pot.
But then it doesn't matter. You start writing. Fill it. Just, you know, it can be arbitrary then.
Yeah.
Just put one thing in it every day, and then at the end of the year you have a long poem. Just read it.
Maybe it could be sacred emptiness. I'm into space. So I would like that space. That could be sacred.
Last one, and we should stop.
So I keep on smiling, thinking about your whole talk about sacred and holy. You and I spent the last 2 weeks putting the doctrine together. You said, you know, we consider meditation a sacred and holy experience. One of our exact sentences.
We're convinced. We're trying to convince the IRS that we're a church. See, it's very interesting. In the U.S., in the old USSR, Buddhism was definitively not a religion. Because being a religion in the old communist regime was not good. It's very easy not to be a religion. But in America, it's really beneficial to be a religion. So we're a religion for sure. If you have any doubts about it,
we're a
church. You're coming to church. You're participating in religion. If anybody from the IRS asks you, you know what to say. It's just concepts. Don't take them too seriously. I hope it's okay with you all. But it's going to make our life a lot easier if the IRS sees us as a church.
That's not lying.
Sorry?
That's not lying.
I don't think it's lying. I think that according to definitions, according to the ways in which the IRS and kind of Western worldview looks at people's the most precious, the most holy, the most religious parts of their life. Buddhism is a religion. Buddhism is a sacred experience. The fact that we have nuances of interpretations of what we mean by all this, it doesn't mean that it's, you know, this is what has primary important value for us, ultimate meaning and value, and it expresses a very profound level of our intention. And I have no trouble. I don't think it's lying.
It's translating
in a sense.
According to their definition.
They might not quite understand what we mean, but they have to come and spend a year with us and hear what we're talking about and practice, and they'll get a sense. And I don't think it's lying. Hope is not lying. If it was, I wouldn't feel good about it.
It was more like we were also saying that for us, meditation is that way of worshiping.
Yeah. So that's what they understand. They understand us. I think it's okay. So, thank you all. Allison?